today on Against the Grain. What has capitalism done to and with time? How does it regulate and discipline workers from the standpoint of time? And what would the struggle to take back time, to reappropriate it, look like? I'm CS. We'll re-present a conversation with the radical historian Brian Palmer about work, life, and capitalist temporality, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. There's wages, there's working conditions, and then there's time. Time, the labor time mandated by capitalists and the leisure time craved by workers, has been a key site of struggle. Labor management negotiation often centers on wages and benefits, but time, says my guest Brian Palmer, is an essential dimension that must be addressed if capitalism is to be tamed and ideally, in his opinion, abolished. According to Palmer, cherished notions like a fair day's wage for a fair day's work must be reconsidered and in some cases discarded. Brian D. Palmer is Emeritus Professor of History at Trent University in Ontario, Canada, and the author of many books, including E.P. Thompson, Objections and Oppositions, and the two-volume Marxism and Historical Practice. An essay he wrote about work and capitalist temporality appears in Socialist Register 2021. The volume has the title Beyond Digital Capitalism, New Ways of Living. When Brian Palmer and I connected recently, I asked him about the statement in his essay that time has become the challenge for socialists to address.
I think that the reason that I pressed so much on time being a challenge for socialists is that we have always known that time is important in the class struggle, and that much of the workers' movement in its history has been about the struggle over time, and in particular, the struggle to limit the nature of the working day. Marx addressed this, but virtually every workers' movement, trade union, and socialist mobilization has been concerned with limiting the working day, trying to draw back a little more for labor against capital. The difficulty now is that because of the changing nature of the economy, because of shifts towards different ways of working, and particularly in the moment of the pandemic, with the way that work has in some sectors been shifted out of enclosed factory-like workspaces and into homes, we've been pushed back in many sectors, not all by any means, but in many, to really hearkening back to almost the putting out system of the early Industrial Revolution. And so the whole question of how one fights overtime and how one limits time has now changed remarkably. And in some senses, it really does shift, as Marx would have suggested, the struggle, which in fairly mainstream terms has been posed as a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, i.e. limit the hours of labor. It's now been shifted, in my view, for socialists to put the accent on where Marx felt it should always lay, which is the abolition of the wages system. And a part of this, too, is that the struggle to reduce the hours of labor seems to have reached something of what we might consider, in bourgeois economic terms, its natural limits. That is, the struggle over the working day, pretty much by the 1950s in advanced capitalist economies, had pretty much come down to reducing the working day to the eight-hour day. But that clearly did not resolve all the problems of the working class. It clearly did not, in fact, lessen the intensities of exploitation. Marx always suggested that while the struggle for the limited working day and reducing the hours of labor was central, he also knew that every time the working class was able to effect a reduction in the hours of labor. Capital would be capable, under capitalism as a system, of intensifying work, of getting more out of those reduced labor hours by introducing technologies, drive systems, scientific management of labor, so-called, et cetera, et cetera. And so at our particular conjuncture, a whole series of developments, it seems to me, had come together by 2019, 2020, to suggest that the struggle over time had to take on both a new intensity for the working class and perhaps new sets of meanings and drawing up new boundaries and new expectations. Limiting the hours of labor might not be enough. And there are so many different ways that so many sectors of the working class can't limit their hours of labor. I mean, you can't really limit the hours of labor when, in a gigified economy, for instance, you're basically working on minute, you know, creating particular bits of knowledge at so many cents a bit that then Amazon is able to use. This and a whole series of other things that again relate to the pandemic and people's hours of labor not having the boundaries that they once had. It struck me that time now really is of the essence.
So Marx worried, as you said he knew, that shortening the work week would mean that capitalists would respond by intensifying work. Talk more then about the level of importance Marx assigned to the struggle for a shorter workday, for laws that limited the length of the workday.
Well, I think, you know, for Marx, that was essential. And in his time, when the workday might well be 12 to 14 hours, and when people were working through the night in many different, you know, sectors, he understood well that the struggle over the working day was of monumental significance. Marx wrote in an address to the First International Workingmen's Association that time is basically the room of human development. Now, I think what differentiated Marx from so many workers who understood intuitively this importance of time was that Marx grasped that as long as the ultimate power lay with capital and capitalism as a system, that capital would always have the capacity to take any short-term victories that the workers' movement extracted from capital. Marx understood well that as long as capitalism is intact, those victories by the working class will be short-lived and they will be able to be turned around by capital. We've seen this in so many different ways. But it did not mean that he therefore said, well, don't struggle for those, because he understood that the path to a mass mobilization of workers that could actually prove to be what he always wanted those to be, the gravedigger of capitalism, that it would take time, it would take many, many victories, many, many mobilizations, many, many instances that saw the realization of class consciousness moving forward gradually and incrementally. So Marx, like Lenin, would never have seen, for instance, to be trade unions per se, to be an ultimate answer to capitalism. He would never see an increase in wages to be per se the resolution of the class question. He would never see the reduction of the hours of labor in and of itself to be a final answer to class exploitation. But he saw all of these things as, if you will, important building blocks in the struggle to create mobilizations of workers, developments of class consciousness, realization of new political forms that would ultimately take capitalism and bury it both economically and politically as a regime of accumulation.
The French Marxist Paul Lafargue, he wrote an essay called The Right to be Lazy, published in 1880. What did he argue?
In some senses, he was offering his particular response to all of what we just talked about. The tendency to see in the purely economic advance of the working class an answer to class exploitation, class inequality, poverty, destitution. What Lafarge argued is that the workers' movement needed to fight those fights, yes, but it also needed to always be struggling for a social transformation that allowed for the right not to work, for the right not to be exploited, for the right to indulge in all of the human and sensual capacities. And Marx was actually very much aligned with this too, but he seldom actually addressed it in the same way that Lafarge did. So Lafarge was really trying to, and by the time that Lafarge wrote that, of course, the trade union movements had become, in some senses, in some places in the advanced capitalist world, powerful entities, or they were beginning to be more powerful than they had been, for instance, in the 1830s or 40s. And so what Lafarge was, in some senses, doing was striking a blow at what Lenin would later call the economism of the trade union movement, the Gompers-like view that all that the workers' movement had to be about was wages and more wages and more wages, slightly better conditions, dropping of the hours of labor. Lafarge wanted the workers' movement to be in the forefront of creating the possibility of a sensuous human society in which there were options beyond the drudgery of employment.
Brian Palmer is his name. He's Emeritus Professor of History and former Canada Research Chair at Trent University in Ontario, Canada. He's an author, he's an historian of labor and the left, and we are talking about an essay he wrote about work and capitalist temporality. It appears in Socialist Register 2021, which has the title Beyond Digital Capitalism, New Ways of Living. Well, we can't really talk about capitalism's assault on time, on workers' time, without speaking about Frederick Winslow Taylor. He lived from 1856 to 1915. What did he do in terms of efforts to control, measure, and regulate the time spent by workers on the job?
Well, Taylor was an incredibly compulsive personality, and he worked out of the Bethlehem Steelworks. And what he did was, when he went into those works, he was convinced that the workers were slacking off. And he was convinced that there was one best way to do every job, and it could be monitored by stopwatches, slide rules, and the most efficient use of what he regarded really as the human machinery of the working class body. And he took a man named Schultz loading pig iron, and he basically did a kind of very acute analysis of his human movements and the shovel, the amount of material that could be loaded and unloaded in particular ways. And he basically created, you know, one efficient movement. And he thought this was the way one could scientifically manage the entire labor process. He was, in some senses, the most ultimate voice of managerial intervention into the productive process. And his ideas, while quite extreme, never managed to actually get a grip on the entirety of working class life in the United States, where he was located. But he did set a tone for interventions by experts into the labor process that in some senses would lead directly into more automated forms of the assembly line like that Henry Ford introduced. So he set a tone for not just time as the working day, but time as every intricate, involved human activity within the labor process.
What was the situation of people in the U.S., their work days, in the 1910s and 20s, how often or how much did they work per week?
Well, it would have depended very much on the sector that one worked in. More casualized labor on the docks or in fairly unskilled construction gangs, they could well be working 14-hour days, 6 days a week, with virtually no vacations and enforced layoffs when seasonal weather conditions dictated that they couldn't work, et cetera, but without, for instance, any pay, of course. The working day would generally be, even in the early 20th century, most workers were working at a minimum in a 9-hour day and some much more. It really wasn't until the 1940s and 50s that you got a generalized 8-hour day in many work sectors. And even in others, that was not necessarily the norm, and there could be enforced overtime as well.
Right, and many of these advances come long after protests and sustained activism by workers demanding a shorter work day. And, you know, to talk about that history of protest and agitation would take, of course, more time than we have now. But to what extent did capitalists respond to calls for a shorter work day with violence, with brutality?
Well, I think the key moment in terms of American history on this is 1886 and the struggle for the 8-hour day, which was centered in Chicago. The movement had been led by not just the Federated Trades and Labor Unions, but also by anarcho-communists, people like Albert Parsons and August Spies, who were really anarcho-communists in terms of their self-designation. There was a mass meeting on the Haymarket Square to secure the 8-hour day. It had followed on the heels of a major strike at the McCormick's Agricultural Implements Works. A bomb was exploded. A rally was broken up. Police were injured and killed, as were workers. And in the aftermath of that, I would argue this unleashed the first Red Scare in America. And 8 anarcho-communist leaders were indicted and brought to trial, 4 of whom were given sentences, 4 of whom were sentenced to death, including Albert Parsons and Louis Ling, sentenced to death. Parsons had not even been on the Haymarket when the bomb exploded. Ling managed to have a comrade smuggle in a dynamite cap and essentially blew himself up in his jail cell, robbing the hangman of the capacity to take him to his death. That was a moment of extreme reaction, and it showed how both the state and employers were driven to the point of execution of workers to stop mobilizations for the shorter working day. Beyond that, the history of the struggle for the shorter working day is intimately related to the struggle for mass industrial unionism in the non-craft union occupation sectors, the rise of these unions really associated with the Congress of Industrial Organizations in the 1930s. And this was when workers in the auto, steel, rubber, electrical sectors that are the foundation of the mass production industry in the modern economy, they organized. And they were centrally involved in the struggle for securing the shorter working day, which again really took off with the accelerating authority of these unions during the 1940s and the World War II epoch and into the 1950s, the sort of heyday of mass production unionism. And from there, the 60s saw younger and militant workers try to push again the envelope to reduce the hours of labor. In some senses, that struggle came to a halt in 1970, in the early to mid-1970s, when in some senses, we were ushered into the neoliberal age of austerity, and the trade unions have been, union movement has been on the defensive ever since.
Yeah, and returning to the 1960s, this is when Marx's economic and philosophical manuscripts of 1844 became widely available in English. So only in the 1960s did this happen. What impact did these texts have on the way people thought about time under capitalism?
I think the influence of the economic and philosophic manuscripts of 1844, which you quite rightly point to, really only became sort of known in the 1960s, is that they ushered into being a new sensibility among those drawn to Marxism, particularly the young, radicalizing, anti-Vietnam War, anti-nuclear bomb elements of the New Left. What the economic and philosophic manuscripts of 1844 suggested was how Marx had grappled before he wrote his better-known economic text, which focused on capital, wage, labor, and profit, etc. Before that, Marx had grappled with issues of humanity, issues of sensuous human activity, issues of how do we create man in a new and transformed way. How he addressed this was through the alienation of labor, through human beings being alienated from their labor because they are not the recipients of the fruits of their labor. Some of that labor is stolen from them by capitalists. And this creates alienated human beings. And a part of this was about time and how one relates to it. What is your time? What is the boss's time? What is the difference? And many New Left writers of the 1960s, like Herbert Marcuse, for instance, who wrote One Dimensional Man and a series of other texts, drew on these economic and philosophic manuscripts and drew on the whole question of alienated human beings to begin to address more frontally how people could change and how they could break out of boundaries within which they were enclosed, many of which were boundaries established by capital. So this was an important liberating moment. It arose right at the time when sociologists and others were talking about the problem of leisure. And it's odd now, if you look back at the last 60 years, to think that leisure would ever have been a problem. But with the developments that we've been talking about, with the arrival of the 8-hour and even shorter work days in some work sectors, and with the development of technologies, robotics, automation, etc., many, many social commentators, including, by the way, Keynes, as early as the 1930s, were predicting that by the opening decades of the 21st century, the work week would be so significantly reduced that we would not know what to do with ourselves in terms of leisure time. Keynes in 1930 predicted a work week of maybe 15 hours a week. Sociologists of the mainstream in the late 50s, early 60s were talking about, you know, working weeks of 20 hours.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Brian D. Palmer joins me. He's an historian. He's an author of many books, including James P. Cannon and the Origins of the American Revolutionary Left, 1890 to 1928, Marxism and Historical Practice, that's a two-volume work, and his book, James P. Cannon and the Emergence of Trotskyism in the United States, 1928 to 1938, is forthcoming from Brill this fall. We are talking about an essay he contributed to Socialist Register 2021, which has the title Beyond Digital Capitalism, New Ways of Living. Brian's essay is entitled The Time of Our Lives, Reflections on Work and Capitalist Temporality. Well, one thinker you bring up in this piece who took some exception to this idea or this reality that sociologists in the 1960s were talking about this problem of leisure was the radical historian E.P. Thompson, best known perhaps for his The Making of the English Working Class, published in 1963. Why did E.P. Thompson find this focus on leisure misplaced or wrongheaded?
Well, what Thompson was sort of astounded at was that leisure had now become, in the eyes of these commentators, a problem. How do we actually deal with people who aren't working 40 hours a week? Thompson said in an essay he wrote on time and work discipline, so when did leisure become a problem? For much of humanity, he said, the struggle has been for more leisure. And whenever we've had more leisure, we've never really had a problem, knowing how to fill our lives. So he thought that the potential, and he bought into it in some ways, that the potential for less work was actually a positive human good. And he could see many ways in which people could revert back to more human interactions and less scripted and engineered lives in terms of what capital and capitalists needed of them.
I see. So E.P. Thompson was looking back to some point in the past when he thought kind of cycles or senses or experiences of time were saner, were more appropriate to the human condition?
Yes. And in his time and work discipline essay, which ranged broadly over the course of the centuries from 1400 into the early 20th century. He looked back at times when in peasant cultures or in seafaring and fishing societies that work was governed by, in some senses, the rhythms of everyday life. Everyday life and work were governed by common rhythms. You can only till the fields in certain seasons and in certain weather. It's not like a factory system. You can only fish the seas in the same kind of circumstances. This made him, I think, perhaps romanticize a bit unduly the sort of reciprocities of work and life. And as I was writing this essay, and I think Thompson is one of the great historians of the mid to late 20th century, one of the greatest, and his Making of the English Working Class has been a monumentally influential work. But I began to see in that 1960s essay on time and work discipline a bit of a critique of Thompson in the sense that, and again, this is coming from pandemic times, looking back, there is a sense in which romanticizing the connection of work and life can prove a problem. And I think a gendered perspective suggests this as well. Women have always had perhaps a deeper understanding of the reciprocities of work and life, given that their working lives have often been structured also around domestic needs, child rearing, nurturing, caring, food preparation, etc. And they know that this isn't always a romanticized existence. It can sometimes pile up too much onto, the one plate of work and life. And in the pandemic, a part of what capital did was shift work out of the workplace and into living spaces. And we all know how difficult it was, especially for women, but for men who are taking more responsibilities in childcare and domestic life as well of late, how difficult it was to juggle working from home on your computer when you have two children at home who are not in school, but are basically schooling at home on a computer, which has to be monitored by you and has to be watched by you. I mean, how you juggle this situation in which work and life have been thrown together, it's not easy. It's not to be romanticized necessarily.
Right, it's very different than the situation of, let's say, artisans in traditional societies engaged in handicraft production, where, as C.P. Thompson would say, life and work become sort of intermingled. This is a new kind of situation that he may not have foreseen.
Exactly, but I'd also shift the gears a bit and say maybe the old situation had some drawbacks too. Peasant life, even though it did have a reciprocity of work and life, and the artisan handicraft production centered in the home, even though it combined work and life, it may well have had dimensions of sort of claustrophobic and tense and stressful dimensions to it, which we just have difficulty penetrating because the historical records of these people don't necessarily bring forth those problems, those difficulties, those pressures and those anguishes.
And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Brian Palmer, that's Brian with a Y. Brian Palmer joins me. He is Emeritus History Professor at Trent University in Ontario, Canada, author of books like E.P. Thompson, Objections and Oppositions, and Canada's 1960s. He joins us today to talk about an essay he wrote that is part of Socialist Register 2021, the 57th annual volume of the Socialist Register. The volume has the title Beyond Digital Capitalism, New Ways of Living. It's edited by Greg Albo and the late Leo Panitch. Brian's article is entitled The Time of Our Lives, Reflections on Work and Capitalist Temporality. Right, and we're talking about an essay that E.P. Thompson wrote. The full title is Time, Work Discipline, and Industrial Capitalism. It was published in 1967. You write that Thompson's essay, this essay, rewrote the history of primitive accumulation. That's another big topic, but briefly, what is primitive accumulation? And maybe more to the point of where you were going with this article, has primitive accumulation ended? Is it a historical phenomenon?
Primitive accumulation, the original accumulation, was Marx's way of addressing how capitalism came into being. While capitalism is a system of accumulation, a regime of accumulation, if you will, the real question is, how did we get to the point where some capitalists were able to exploit and extract surplus value from a mass of workers? And in order to get to that point, you have to have people, workers, who are not only willing to work for wages, but who are forced into a condition that they have to work for wages. So you have to strip them of, for instance, their either relationship to or traditional ownership and occupation of land. You have to strip them of their skills in artisan, small-scale handicraft production that allow them to produce goods on a small scale. And you have to make them into people who are not their own masters anymore, cannot make determinations of how to provide for themselves, but must rely on people hiring them for wages. And so primitive accumulation involves all kinds of processes, but in the classic case of the English Industrial Revolution, it involved using enclosures, for instance, to drive a peasant class off the land and away from the commons that they had access to for millennia, and made them into a group dependent entirely upon wages. If you look at colonial situations, primitive accumulation is about dispossessing indigenous peoples, driving them from the land, concentrating ownership in the hands of small enclaves of capitalists. The way in which primitive accumulation had traditionally been treated in orthodox Marxist literature was about these processes of dispossession. But what Thompson did, it seemed to me, in the time and work discipline essay, and it was an amazingly creative and imaginative essay, was to say, okay, and he never posed it this way, but this is my reading of it. He say, okay, men and women were driven off the land. They did have skills that were basically de-skilled as technologies replaced their handicraft knowledge. But you also need, in primitive accumulation, a cultural remaking of humanity. You have to acclimatize humanity to the rigors and disciplines of, for instance, factory employment. The bells ring in the morning, you have to go to work. The bells ring in the late in the day, you can come home. You have to acclimatize people who are not used to that kind of regimented life. That they, not only do they belong in this factory system, they are inured to it. They adapt to it. And so the time and work discipline essay that Thompson wrote really showed how time was used as a new way of disciplining people. And not only did people react to it as discipline, they internalized that discipline. Now, as for primitive accumulation, it's my view that it never ends. It's always ongoing. Capital always needs new ways to discipline and reconfigure humanity to accept the conditions that capital will find beneficial.
What's been reported about what's happened to the average work week, let's say in the US and Canada and in Europe, over the last few decades and in, you know, more recent years?
Well, the statistics are and the data are really unambiguous on this. The work week has been inching upwards and upwards after really a century from the 1840s at least into the 1940s when workers struggled to limit and constrain the length of the working day. And when, with powerful trade unions by the 20th century, able to secure legislation that legally restricted, you know, and put boundaries around working time. From the 70s on, the statistics and the data and the experience all confirm that we have seen the hours people are working inch upward and upward and upward. Now, again, it varies from sector to sector, but if you look at the technology and finance sectors, workers now there are estimated in the U.S. to be working 60 hours a week. There have been studies done that have shown that more and more workers are doing more and more of their work at home. And this was before the pandemic. Now that the pandemic has happened, and capital has learned that you can actually have people doing their work outside of the confines of office cubicles, even outside of the confines of, you know, factory employments, this trend is definitely going to continue. So we have seen a ratcheting up of the hours of labor. And again, this is consistent with what Marx predicted over the long haul. He didn't envision clearly what was going to happen in 2020. But he understood the logic of capital as always struggling, always working to extend interminably the length of the working day. And that is indeed what has happened and what has been happening of late in exaggerated, I would say, forms, accentuated forms.
Brian D. Palmer joins us on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. He is Emeritus Professor of History and former Canada Research Chair at Trent University in Ontario, Canada. You bring up in this piece in Socialist Register 2021 the argument that, yeah, we could say, like in the abstract, that a reduction of hour is required by any single employer of an employee is a good thing. And yet there are factors that you want us to take seriously. One is that a reduction in hours might mean employees don't can't make enough money in a single job to make ends meet. And second, that sometimes reducing hours are a way of employers escaping certain obligations that they owe to, for example, full-time workers.
Yes. Speaking, I think this is true. I wouldn't necessarily want to hold to it, but I believe that, you know, Walmart is always happy to keep people at 30 or just under 30 hours a week. And in doing that, they avoid benefits. And there are many corporations which I'm sure are following the same trajectory. That is, as long as you can keep people on almost a full-time, you know, workload, and expect, by the way, work that corresponds to a full-time workload. If you keep the hours below a certain threshold, you can avoid certain legal obligations. It's also the case that more and more employers have found that they have less and less of a contentious issue around their workforce struggling to reduce the hours of labor. Because, again, as I've said, since 1973, we've been in this austerity-driven neoliberal environment where, quite frankly, the terms of trade and the class war have shifted very much to the benefit of employers. With unemployment at the levels it's been, most workers aren't struggling to win less hours. They're struggling to hang on to the hours that they have. And employers know this. More and more of the precarious type work that is available, particularly for younger people, is work that does not conform to a 40-hour factory employment situation with union protections. Instead, you are often paid by the piece, and you are working from home in a, quote, knowledge economy. In that situation, even when employers can monitor your every move, as they can in so many gigified sectors, how many hours you work is of no concern to the employer, and it's nothing that the worker has any kind of recourse to sort of claim lesser hours. They've got to work in order to produce these pieces by which they are paid minuscule amounts. Again, this is why I started out the essay by saying the struggle over time is going to be of fundamental importance for socialists. Because the traditional way in which time was fought over in unionized sectors that could demand and could rely on their power to secure, even from the state, certain concessions in terms of the limits of on the working day, that really isn't what's on the agenda right now. It's simply not possible. So how one struggles over time, but the necessity of struggling for time, this is very much in flux at the current moment. And it is necessary to sort of rethink and reinvigorate, I would suggest, the concern with time.
Brian Palmer talking about an essay he wrote called The Time of Our Lives. And in that piece, you indicate the fact that automation and digitalization certainly threaten the work hours of workers, threaten to take jobs out of the hands of humans. I want to move on to the struggle, the goal of the struggle, the target of the struggle over time, as you see it. What should be done with and to time? How can time be delivered from the clutches of capitalism? You began this interview by talking about the wage system and its desirability, right? I mean, we all just assume that's the way work goes. You put in a day's work, you put in an hour's work, and you get a wage. I think you have a different sense of whether that's appropriate.
Yeah, in a sense, I think that all of these struggles that the working class has historically been engaged in and will continue to be engaged in are monumentally important. Struggles around the length of the working day, the nature of job conditions, struggles around automation and how it is used, what it creates for workers and what it how it displaces them. These are struggles that are going to continue, and they will continue in many and varied forms. The question of time is intricately related to this, not only the working day, but whose time is what and how that time is to be used. Ultimately, the issue is, can any of these issues really rebound, however they are resolved, to the benefit of the working class under capitalism? And my response to that would be, they cannot be. Like Marx, I think that they will always be capable of being reconfigured, restructured, redefined by capital in ways that rebound to its good effects. So in some senses, my answer is not that one, for instance, forgoes a struggle around time, or forgoes a struggle for unionization, or forgoes a struggle against the pernicious impacts of automation and digitalization. But I think they will be better fought for, and they will be building blocks towards a transition towards a socialist society, if it is always held in mind that the ultimate aim is not the creation of a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, which is the mainstream liberal banner of conventional trade unionism, but rather Marx's banner, abolition of the wages system. Time will take on an entirely different meaning in a socialist society, in a society that's experienced a revolutionary transformation, than it has under centuries of capitalism. Automation will take on an entirely different meaning. The relations of human beings to one another as workers within the boundaries of the working day will take on entirely different meanings. But we will only get to those possibilities of difference if the struggle for time, for wages, and for work, and for conditions that are humane, if it is borne in mind that the struggle really is ultimately about capitalism. Now, how one bridges those transitions from those particularistic struggles within capitalism to a larger struggle to, in the process, create the structures, the institutions, the consciousness that will lead towards socialism. To me, that's the big question. And it's not a question that I think we can actually broach in the time remaining. And it's not a question that one should be arrogant about, because I think one needs a certain humility before the sort of grandiose nature of the problem. But unless we think in those terms, I think all we are doing is struggling for small changes that are always capable of being reversed and turned against themselves. It doesn't mean you don't struggle for them and fight for them and try to secure victories. But there is a necessity for a larger vision. And I think that larger vision will also animate better, more informed, more creative, and more imaginative struggles as well.
When you write that we must repudiate the fairness of the wage, the fairness of any wage, I assume you're referring to the fact that what workers receive as pay does not equal the value of their labor. The employer appropriates what Marx calls surplus value, and that reaping of profit constitutes the basis of exploitation. And so eliminating the wage is key to any worker emancipation.
Well, exactly. Exactly. The wage system is premised on theft. This is a fundamental Marxist axiom, and I have seen nothing to actually displace my view that it is an entirely correct way of looking at the wage. Now, of course, you can't in some ultimatist way just go into trade unions and interact with workers and say, well, you have to tomorrow march out and say abolish the wage. It's not the way it works, and that will get you nowhere. But you can, in the process of, you know, building mobilizations of all different kinds and all kinds of coalitions, with workers and with people who are not necessarily workers, bring together people in the project of creating socialism in ways that, conveys that fundamental notion that when you have a wage system, you have a system in which people are exploited and inevitably going to be exploited. And that exploitation drifts into all manner of special oppressions, which are very much on the agenda in terms of opposition today around race, gender, sexual differentiation, et cetera, disability. All of these things are in many ways related to the wage system because they could not, in fact, function the way they do on their own backs. They rely on capitalism. They are embedded in capitalism as a system premised on an original theft. And that's the project that it strikes me needs to be built. An understanding of that and of struggles that will enhance understanding of that and lead towards ways of overcoming that system and that regime of accumulation.
Brian Palmer, Emeritus Professor of History at Trent University and Canada Historian of Labor and the Revolutionary Left, author of books like E.P. Thompson, Objections and Oppositions, Revolutionary Teamsters, The Minneapolis Truckers' Strikes of 1934, the two-volume Marxism and Historical Practice. And you may want to check out his forthcoming book called James P. Cannon and the Emergence of Trotskyism in the United States, 1928-38. We've been talking about an essay about work and capitalist temporality that appears in Socialist Register 2021, edited by Greg Albo and the late, great Leo Panitch. Brian, thanks so much for your work, and thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
And that interview first aired on August 17th, 2021. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.